So keep your Bibles open to 1 Corinthians 8. Let me ask you some questions as we start. How much of an influence does being a Christian have on what you've eaten this last week? Think about the meals you've eaten. How much thought have you given to them as a Christian? What about what you've watched? How does being a Christian change the things you watch, the films, the TV programs? How might it change the games you play? How might it change what you listen to, the podcast, the music, whatever? How about where you go, what you drink, what you spend your money on? Should being a Christian change all those things? And if so, how should it change those things? We're in that part of 1 Corinthians where Paul has dealt with some big theological issues, some problems in the church. Their division over celebrities, sexual immorality in the church, he's dealt with that. And now he's in this section where he's dealing with problems that the church have written to him about. They are a young church. They've probably only been going 4 or 5 years. Paul was there for 18 months. Now he's been gone for 3 and a bit years. And they're beginning to come across issues as a church family. And they're wondering, what does the gospel say about this? We saw last week they were asking, what does the gospel say about marriage? What does it say about divorce? What about, does it say about those who are engaged? This week, you can see what the issue is there in verse 1, can't you? The issue is, what does the gospel have to say about food sacrificed to idols? In other words, can we as a church eat food that's been offered to idols in the temples? Now that seems like a bit of an odd question to us, doesn't it? But it's a massive issue for them. Their temples work very differently from the way our churches work. So the temple would exist, the temple to a god or a goddess, and around it would be courtyards. And the courtyards were integral to business and to social life. Everything revolved around those courtyards. You had a sacred space where offerings were made, meat and vegetables and fruit and all sorts of things like that. But around them you had courtyards that were places to eat, and you had marketplaces, like market stalls set up outside the temples. Think of it a bit like a church with Meadow Hall's food court around it. That's kind of what it was like. And all of life in Corinth revolved around those courtyards. If you were in business, that might be where someone you wanted to sell to or buy from or go into partnership with would say to you, oh great, we'll meet at this or this goddess's temple and we'll have a meal together and we'll talk about it. Your family might say to you, it's a big birthday, let's meet at this god or this goddess's temple and we'll have a celebration. Partly because the temples always had meat. And in those days, most families didn't eat meat. So for big celebrations, you'd go somewhere you could get the meat. But here's the thing, all of the meat, the vegetables, the fruit sold in those marketplaces, eaten at those kind of restaurants around the temple, all of it had beforehand been part of a worship service to an idol. Can you eat it or can't you eat it? As a church, there are some of those who are from a Jewish background, but many of them in Corinth are from a Greek background, a Gentile background, and they would have worshipped idols beforehand. And here's the big question. Can we eat that food or can't we eat that food? Can we eat the meat? Can't we eat the meat? And how do we decide what we do? Now, this topic is big. Paul spends 3 chapters looking at this. So chapter 8, we're going to look at this morning. Chapter 9, he gives a worked example for himself of the principles he's going to give us in chapter 8. And then chapter 10 that we'll come to after Easter, he comes back to the same issue and uses Israel as an example of how we should relate to idol feasts and celebrations. And one of the things he says, there is a difference between what you eat and where you eat it and whether you join in with an idol worship. And we're going to focus on chapter 8 this morning. And the questions kind of swirling around it for the Corinthians are vast. But he starts here in chapter 8 by lifting their eyes from themselves and my rights as an individual. He starts by lifting their eyes to who God is and then to their church family. And he gives them 3 principles in this chapter that I think are really helpful. Here's the first one. Don't just know about God, be known by God. Don't just know about God, be known by God. That's there in verses 1 to 3. Corinthian culture was all about pride and prestige and power and pedigree and performance and prosperity. That's what they thrived on. And part of that in Greek culture was your use of knowledge. They loved flaunting how intelligent they were. It sounds a bit geeky to us, but crowds used to gather to watch the really clever people debate stuff. They used to, you know, have big days where you could come and you could listen to people making these really clever arguments. And it was all about knowledge as power. And here's the problem that has crept into the church. If I know something, it gives me power. And if I know something, I should do whatever it is that I know. In verses 1 to 3, Paul uses the word know or knowledge 6 times, because that's the big issue. He refers to the knowledge they know, the danger of knowing, and the knowing they should really be longing for. Let's read it again. Now, about food sacrificed to idols, we know that we all possess knowledge. But knowledge puffs up while love builds up. Those who think they know something do not yet know as they ought to know, but whoever loves God is known by God. Now, it's a little bit confusing, isn't it? You might be thinking, that sounds a little bit brain-curdling. Just going to work our way through those verses. What he's saying is there is a danger of knowledge that puffs you up, hence the puffer fish. What's the puffer fish famous for? Cut it wrongly, it kills you as you eat it. What's Paul saying about knowledge here? Knowledge can be dangerous if used wrongly. We'll see at the end, it can destroy a brother or sister. Knowledge has puffed up some in the church in Corinth. It's made them proud, it's made them boastful, and they're flaunting their knowledge by eating whatever they want, whenever they want to use it. That's the issue Paul's confronting there in verses 1 and 2. Knowledge puffs up, he says, and by contrast, love, that's Christian love, builds up. Knowledge puffs up the individual. Love builds up others. It's a stark contrast, isn't it? Do you want to be known for knowing lots, or do you want to be known for loving people? That's what he's saying. Do you want to be known as a church that's full of arrogant pride in how much theology it knows? Or do you want to be a church that's known for loving others the way God has loved us? Verse 2, he says, those who think they know something do not know it, yet know it as they ought. What's he saying? He's saying a little bit of knowing is dangerous. You can know something but not be able to put it in context. You can know something but not see it as part of a bigger reality. It's what he goes on to say in verse 3. Look, but whoever loves God is known by God. I wonder what you think the greatest knowing of all is. It's not to know lots of things about what the Bible teaches. It's not even to know lots of big sounding words about God. The Bible tells us the greatest knowing of all is us being known by God. To be known in that we are personally called and saved, redeemed by and reconciled to God, Father, Son, and Spirit. To be adopted by Him and at peace with Him, and to have your name in the Lamb's Book of Life. That's the knowing, the knowledge we should all long for, that God knows us as His children. That's what He's saying to them. Whoever loves God is known by God.